2017, March 28th, 2017, Committee on Veterans Emergency Preparedness for the Oregon House of Representatives is now in order. We're going to modify the plan because that's what we do best. We are going to have three public hearings after we have our invited testimony. We're going to try to move, hopefully, 2574. The other two we need to hold for a little bit. We need to update a fiscal on one, and we need an amendment for the other. But we can get started with the Director of Oregon Emergency Management, Mr. Phelps. Please come forward and introduce yourself for the record and make us smarter.
Thank you, Chair Evans, members of the committee. I'm Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Military Department's Office of Emergency Management, and I'm pleased to be here today to provide an overview of Citizen Corps programs here in Oregon. In addition to a brief history of Citizen Corps, I will share background information on Citizen Corps program funding levels over the past 15 years and how this resource is leveraged here in Oregon and other programs that serve similar functions to CCP or Citizen Corps. Sort of in full disclosure here, Citizen Corps programs have a very special spot in my heart. 15 years ago, I was living in the shadow of Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan, struggling to understand the long-term impacts of the September 11th attacks our country had just experienced. Like most folks in New York and across the country, I wanted to be part of the solution, but was completely unsure how to do that, having taken no more than a CPR first aid class when I was in high school. That was the extent of my emergency response and management training and background. Some research online using dial-up internet, that dated the conversation a little bit, I found something called emergency management and found an innovative way to leverage a community's desire to help prepare for and respond to emergencies and disasters called Citizen Corps. Citizen Corps was officially launched during President Bush's 2002 State of the Union Address as part of his USA Freedom Corps program. The Citizen Corps program consists of five subcomponents: the Medical Reserve Corps, Fire Corps, Volunteer and Police Services, or VIPS, Neighborhood Watch Programs, and the Community Emergency Response Team Program. Community Emergency Response Team, or CERT, also has some subsets. There's Campus CERT, which is geared towards university campuses, Teen CERT, which is geared towards high school age students, and Facility CERTs, like hospitals, applying the same concept of Community Emergency Response Team training to individual facilities like hospitals and medical facilities. This effort has been led by the U.S. Department of Homeland Security in partnership with other federal agencies, including Health and Human Services and the Department of Justice. Nationwide, there are over 1,200 local or tribal Citizen Corps councils. Each state and territory maintains a Citizen Corps council, and over 7,000 CERT, Medical Reserve Corps, Fire Corps, or VIPS programs, serving 75% of the nation's population. Here in Oregon, we have over 100 active Citizen Corps programs, including 97 CERT teams, 20 Medical Reserve Corps teams, and several VIPS and Fire Corps programs throughout the state. Initially, Citizen Corps programs were funded as a separate carve out through the Homeland Security Grant Program, the HSGP. In 2003, the first year of that grant program, the state of Oregon received $583,000 to fund Citizen Corps programs and component initiatives. That grant program, like many others administered by the Department of Homeland Security, began to dwindle. In its final year of set-aside funding, which was 2011, $148,000 was allocated to the state of Oregon through the Homeland Security Grant Program to fund Citizen Corps initiatives. Since that time, funding has fluctuated based on project applications that we receive from our local and tribal partners, anywhere from $106,000 to $202,000 funded annually through that grant program. But over the last 12 years, the state of Oregon has flowed $2.5 million in federal funding to Citizen Corps program initiatives. This, of course, does not factor in non-federal funds used by local jurisdictions to build and sustain these programs. Overall, more than 2,000 Oregonians volunteer their time to participate in Citizen Corps programs throughout the state. In Clatsop County, they've expanded their program to begin teaching teen cert classes at all three high schools in the county in health and sciences curriculum this school year, 2016 to 2017. Lincoln County CERT trains not only with local public safety agencies, but also with Coast Guard helicopter crews and their rescue swimmer teams. Polk County delivered a CERT class in American Sign Language and have recruited a deaf ASL fluent CERT instructor who will begin teaching at the National Emergency Management Institute in 2017. Polk County has also recruited a bilingual English-Spanish CERT instructor to expand the reach of their programs. In Medford, the Medford Emergency Management Agency taught a CERT class at Rogue Valley Manor, a high-rise senior living facility with almost 1,000 residents. Many of the CERT graduates were staff, but 23 were facility residents, including a 91-year-old resident of that facility. And in Coos County, CERT has trained almost 600 people, and their program has 200 active members, including 20 instructors who teach several times a year. They have active CERT teams in over a half a dozen communities and also cross-train with neighboring counties. Did a little bit of research and I'm pleased to report that everybody that sits on this committee has at least one active Citizen Corps program within their jurisdiction. So there's certainly a far reach of Citizen Corps programs. Volunteer engagement can be a challenge. We see nationwide dwindling numbers in our volunteer fire departments, and certainly Citizen Corps programs are no different. I think we see a lot of creativity when you have leadership and emergency managers with Citizen Corps programs finding ways to leverage that resource in ways to keep their team members engaged and keep their skills sharp. Over the last several years, this has certainly been true with our disaster response, as well as utilizing CERT resources or Citizen Corps program resources to respond or participate in planned events. In January of 2017, this past January, snow removal and welfare checks in Edina were conducted by the CERT teams, including 137 volunteer hours and 304 different structures were checked to check on residents within that community. The Oregon State University meningitis B vaccination clinic at Oregon State, that also utilized Medical Reserve Corps volunteers to facilitate that process. Back in November 2015, following the tragic shooting at Umpqua Community College, behavioral health support was brought in through the Medical Reserve Corps to assist the city of Roseburg as they recovered from that tragedy. Our full-scale exercise in June of 2016, Cascadia Rising, leveraged CERT volunteers and Citizen Corps volunteers from across the state. Depot Bay Memorial Day Fleet of Flowers, a planned event in that community, utilizes their Citizen Corps programs, as does the Cloverdale 4th of July Parade. Going back a couple of years, the flooding in Linn and Benton counties in January 12th saw a tremendous show of support from their CERT volunteers to both do welfare checks, provide traffic control, and alert residents of the dangers of the flooding in those communities. And the Linn-Benton Vulnerable Population Shelter exercise in December of 2013 was supported in large part by Citizen Corps volunteers. There's a lot of ways for folks to get involved at the community level. I often think about my introduction to emergency management through the CERT team that I helped found in New York City following the September 11th terrorist attacks, and often think how important that experience has been to me and the impact that it had on my career and the communities that I've lived in. It's important to note that while Citizen Corps is probably the most visible and most supported, perhaps, volunteer opportunity in our communities, there's other programs as well that are out there, and I'd like to call your attention to some of those. Portland utilizes a very similar concept to CERT through their neighborhood emergency teams, tremendously effective outreach program, and they've trained thousands of citizens of Portland in much of the same concepts that CERT provides training, search and rescue, first aid, communications, and the like. The Map Your Neighborhood program is similar to CERT, but on a much smaller scale, where you can have individual blocks, cul-de-sacs, and smaller community organizations learn about what their hazards are in their communities, the resources they have available, and provide some training about how to help their neighbors during a bad day. Amateur Radio Emergency Services, or ARES, and other auxiliary communication groups are great ways for citizens to get involved in being part of that preparedness and response posture, as are individual communities of interest. This is fascinating, the different communities that tend to pop up everywhere from hackathons, where folks use their computer skills to do digital mapping and track resources or needs a request for assistance throughout communities that have been impacted by disasters. Drone enthusiasts coming together during disasters to make their data that they're capturing through amateur drone use available to emergency responders. Cargo bike owners, a tremendous resource, that fairly informal organization of folks, but they obviously have a wealth of resources they can bring to bear during a disaster. And then, of course, our faith-based communities. In addition to those formal programs, standalone training like CPR and first aid can't be emphasized enough as part of a community's preparedness posture. The more prepared we are individually to respond to medical emergencies and help our neighbors in their time of need, the better off we all are. And I'd also like to call attention to FEMA's recently announced Until Help Arrives program. This is a rather innovative way to do messaging at the community level and the individual level to really empower citizens to be part of that initial response before formal response begins. When I give community presentations, I often ask who the first responders are. And I'm always told, well, it's police officers and firefighters and EMTs. I've been a firefighter for an awfully long time, and I don't know that I've ever been a first responder in that role. Someone's always there before me to call 911. Someone sees the car accident. Someone sees the house on fire. Somebody sees a crime in progress. I would hope if I suffered a heart attack right now, you at all would recognize that you are the first responders and not Instagram my picture as I'm lying on the floor saying, boy, I can't wait till the first responders get here and help this poor guy out. We all have that role to play, and FEMA's program Until Help Arrives is a really innovative approach to teaching folks some of the basic things they can do, like call 911, apply pressure to a severe bleed, or move someone out of harm's way even if they've suffered a traumatic injury. And they've got a very innovative Choose Your Own Adventure YouTube video where citizens can follow along in the video and make decisions along the way as their course of action, what they would do in a given situation. Pretty cool stuff, and it's only about 3 weeks old, so I encourage folks to check that out. If you Google Until Help Arrives, you'll find that information online. Pretty neat stuff. In closing, the unofficial motto of CERT is Neighbors Helping Neighbors. Whether it's severe winter weather leaving drivers stranded in Beaverton, or a tornado in Manzanita, perhaps a wildfire in Grant County, or the unspeakable act of violence in Roseburg, the stories that emerge throughout the state anytime we have a bad day are those neighbors helping neighbors. And Citizen Corps programs, CERT, Medical Reserve Corps, VIPS, Neighborhood Watch, and Fire Corps are great opportunities for folks to get involved in being part of a community's preparedness and response posture. That concludes my prepared remarks, pending any questions.
Okay, thank you. Questions? I've got a few, but before I start asking, do you have any yet?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll start. So right now, Citizen Corps is under OEM, and how often are the leaders or regional coordinators, how often are they communicating with the person that's your lead person at OEM?
Sure. So, Chair Evans, it's important to know that really the organizational structure of Citizen Corps programs happens at the local level. We maintain the statewide Citizen Corps Council, and I think it's been about a year and a half or 2 years since we've had a formal meeting of the Citizen Corps Council at the state level. That said, our Citizen Corps coordinator shares information regularly among the Citizen Corps Council programs, but it's been some time since we've had a formal meeting.
And how does the money actually flow from Homeland Security through this Citizen Corps program to the locals?
Sure. It's Chair Evans, it's a competitive application process for Homeland Security grant program funding. A community typically at the county level will submit an application to the state outlining a number of projects, and Citizen Corps programs and initiatives could be one of those projects. Those are then peer-reviewed and evaluated, making a recommendation to me as the director of OEM to allocate those funds. At that point, then, a subgrant is issued to the requesting county if they've received the award, and the county then manages those funds typically.
So county emergency manager is basically the gateway for that?
Correct. The county emergency managers of the counties become the subgrantees.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, well, for moving forward, one of the hopes that we that I have is for Representative Parrish and whoever else wants to be a part of that conversation to have an opportunity to meet with the person that's tagged with this, as well as perhaps some of the folks that are on the council, to see compared to this year's, if I understand correctly, 106,000 plus or minus.
We've just completed the application review process, so that's to be determined. But it's fluctuated between $100,000 and $200,000 annually since it's not been a carve out of the grant program.
And before then, it was $500,000 plus or minus.
Chair Evans, that's correct. The initial grant in 2003 was about $500,000.
So I'd be curious to see what capacities we may have developed and then got lost as a result of funding changes, and then also see, given the, especially in the areas we know are designated for seismic events, what type of projects maybe people haven't put in for, but they might be willing to put in for if there was some type of match program. So I know that Representative Parrish is very good at, as she claims and does, effectively making dollars stretch farther than they normally can.
One thing.
And I'm looking forward to hearing about that. And thank you very much for this initial presentation. I appreciate it.
Chair Evans, thank you.
Okay. So we're going to close the informational hearing.
By the way, you did a good job.
And for a couple of folks that kind of came in a little bit late, what we're going to be doing is we're going to open a public hearing on 2574. We've had this bill before, but we have an amendment, I believe. And my hope is after we have a public hearing on this, we can actually try to move this particular bill today. Anybody wanting to come forward on 2574? Yeah, go with it. West Guy's looking for the paper. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman. This particular bill, 2574, had a pretty substantial amendment. We call this in the vernacular the get and stuff. Basically, everything from the original bill was taken out and replaced by a dash one amendment. And House Bill 2574 amends the current law, a statute concerning emergency drills and instructions. And schools, per the amendment, would be required to instruct on age-appropriate information for at least 4 hours per school year on survival in the days and weeks after a natural disaster. The Department of Education will be required to develop the age-appropriate curriculum relating to earthquake and tsunami safety for students kindergarten through grade 12. Each school district will be required to implement the curriculum unless the school districts opt out by sending notice to the state resilience officer. The amount to be appropriated to the Department of Education for implementation for the biennium beginning July 1st, 2017 has not been determined. The state amendments would first apply to the 2019-2020 school year. At our last hearing on February 21st, we did not have the complete fiscal back. We had a revenue, and they said no revenue impact. And the fiscal, again, it's one of the long ones. They talk about 1,400 hours of contractor to work, estimated at $56,980. This will be going on further to the Ways and Means Committee.
Okay, so if I could bring people, recollect back when Representative Gomberg brought this forward. We saw the cool video about the teen cert folks at the high school doing all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. We had been working with ODE and others on trying to put the fiscal in a more manageable state. For the folks that have relationships with teen cert and cert information out there, hint, hint, ODE would certainly benefit from continued conversations. ODE's plan right now is to develop a curriculum that is literally grade and age specific, so that fourth graders and fifth graders and sixth graders and seventh graders would get information that fits into a larger comprehensive strategy, so that every year they aren't necessarily learning the exact same thing, they're learning things that connect. It's pretty detailed. If we can pull it off, I think it's very helpful. The other piece that this bill does, it's important to remember, is that current law says that there is a half hour per month for 9 months a year dedicated to this type of training or similar training. This would say instead of that, 4 hours per year. So you could bulk it up so that you could actually do a couple hours at a time twice. You could do a four-hour day. You could do any number of things, a little more flexibility in terms of that. It is Representative Gomberg's idea that This especially given along the coast is something that should be exported. Makes sense to me. The fiscal, we were able to get down to about 56,000 from where we originally started. I do believe ODE is trying to work to make sure that it meets the spirit of the bill. So anybody, I saw no names on the list. Anybody not sign up but want to talk about this before I put the gavel down? Seeing none, okay.
Was now the time to discuss?
We're going to hold that question.
Okay.
Hold that question.
We're going to have a motion to consider the bill. I'm opening a work session on House Bill 2574.
Mr. Chair, I move to adopt House Bill 2574 with the Dash Ones Amendment dated February 15, 2017.
Representative Esquivel moves to adopt House Bill 2174-1 amendments dated February 15, 2017. Is there any discussion? Representative Post.
Yes. Thank you, Ms. Chair. I love the concept and I love the discussion that we had about this before, but I just, in thinking about every school district in Oregon, so this is going to come from ODE.
Yes.
If I'm saying that right, or D of E, whatever it is. Is this saying every school district must comply with this?
Representative Post, great question. Right now, the current law says it's the same requirements now as would be with this.
Okay.
So that schools are supposed to be doing this now with different curricula they have. ODE is planning on putting together a curricula that is specific to seismic events, seismic threats, and post-event survival, which is something that really hasn't been discussed. Putting it into a webinar format so that schools can run the lecture piece and also, I assume, they're talking about workbook type things that are more local to their community. So it is... It is a mandate, but it is a mandate that is adjusting a mandate that already exists, if that makes any sense.
Okay.
And actually, if they can get the webinar thing done, it would probably be easier to implement than what we currently do.
I'd forgotten about the first part. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, sir.
Is not the 4 hours equivalent to what was in the original bill?
It's 4 hours is actually 30 minutes less than the existing standards.
Yeah, it was pretty close.
So some would argue that there's a savings of 30 minutes that could be put back into other instruction time. I don't. Yeah.
So, Mr. Chair, are we voting on the amendment? What are we voting on?
Well, we're going to be voting on the amendment, and then we're going to be voting on the measure.
Thank you.
Is there any discussion or any concern with the amendment, which, again, because this is a full gut and stuff, that's why I kind of wanted to do that. Any objections, any discussion? Yes.
Question, Mr. Chair, on the Section 3, the amount that's appropriated is blank. Is that normal?
The amount, we'll read blank until Ways and Means actually fills it in. We have an estimated fiscal of 56,000 that we're sending down to Ways and Means, but Ways and Means will actually pencil that in. That's a great question. Okay, so I'm sensing no more questions on the amendment. Why don't we call a roll call on the amendment? Again, this is doing the official gut and stuff piece. Sky, hit it, please.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone?
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel?
Aye.
Chair Evans?
Aye. Amendment passes. Now.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2574 as amendment to the House floor with a due pass recommendation with a subsequent referral to the Chair of the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Esquivel moves House Bill 2574 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Nope. 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 Okay, seeing no discussion? Hit it.
Representative Lewis.
Aye.
Representative Lively.
Aye.
Representative Meek.
Aye.
Representative Parrish.
Aye.
Representative Post.
Aye.
Vice Chair Boone.
Aye.
Vice Chair Esquivel.
Aye.
Chair
Evans. Aye. In a squeaker, this one passes, goes to Ways and Means, and I'll tentatively assign Gomberg to it, but Ways and Means, of course, can always change that. Thank you very much for committee on moving that one forward. We're now going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2886. Mr. Volk.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. We last heard this bill on February 21st, and there was a dash one amendment that substantially changed the original bill. And the change is that it removes a specific OEM requirement to develop and implement strategies to select and outfit suitable public places for emergency response and recovery purposes in coordination with other state and local entities. That had been part of the original bill. That has been removed. And instead, it creates within OEM an advisory committee that provides recommendation and advice to OEM regarding expenditures from the Oregon Public Places or Safe Places Investment Fund. It establishes guidelines for the advisory committee and OEM in interacting with the advisory committee. We have received the fiscal and revenue statements on that.
Okay. House Bill 2886, just as a reminder, is designed. Really, we're going to do two things with it and not do the first part. The first part, which was coming up with a plan, my goal is to be presented in a subsequent bill, 2983, that creates a task force approach to coming up with the recommendations. So instead of basically having an agency do it, which is already overworked, we're not going to have the agency do that part. We're going to ask them to participate in the task force and help support it. But this bill, instead of giving the agency that responsibility, it establishes a fund. So when we come up with recommendations and we have some additional money from time to time, we can put it in the fund. And the second thing is it creates an advisory committee to that fund to ensure that all interests have at least some say as we put together our plan. So, yes, sir.
And so all interests, again, we're still, our intent is it be coordinated across agencies because
yes.
ODOT obviously is,
yes,
has similar plans.
Yes, the plan is a little bit out of whack here, but 2983, which we're going to talk about next, will create the task force and recommendations. Okay. When they report out, if passed, this fund will already exist.
Okay.
And the recommendations can basically go, funding for the recommendations can go into the fund. It's basically, we're trying to, accepting that we have financial issues this year. Hopefully in the future there will not be the same financial issues. We're trying to basically put things in place so we can continue with our work.
Okay.
And we are expecting a revised fiscal in 2886, given the changes, so we're not going to be moving this bill today. Okay. Any people wanting to come forward on 2886? I see no names. Anybody going once, twice? Okay, we're going to close the public hearing on 2886. My hope is to move it soon, coming to a committee near you. All right, we're going to open a public hearing on 2983. Mr. Volk, go ahead.
Thank you, Chairman Evans. It creates the Task Force, House Bill 2983, as amended, creates the Task Force on Disaster Response and Recovery to prioritize and recommend upgrades to critical facilities and infrastructure by large-scale emergency response, including a plan for energy self-sufficiency and a list sites to stage response, equipment and personnel, and report to the legislature by December 1st, 2018. It sunsets December 31st, 2018. Takes effect the 91st day after send date. We have received the fiscal and revenue. There is a dash three amendment, and this would replace from 30 to 31 members, and it would also change part of the direction and who is appointed.
And we are working on dash four amendment because one of the agencies we included we did on accident, and I forgot another agency.
Oh.
So OEM will be, Oregon Military Department will be included in the dash four amendments. The goal of this task force is broad, but it is in general to ensure that all the agencies and other interests, special districts for parks and everybody else who wants to participate pretty much, it's a big committee, come together, develop one, two, three, maybe four tiers of priority, and then have the conversations about where geographically make most sense for certain pre-event and post-event investments. The issue with this is the following. Once upon a time, there was a similar conversation, but it was told to agencies as opposed to with agencies. And because agencies have priority investments of their own,
and they have ideas, and they have plans, and they have legislative direction. Instead of downward, the goal of this task force is to literally bring people into the room, recognize the major categories of investments that need to be done, and then have a team approach over literally 10 or 15 years of investments to make sure that we're measuring twice and cutting once, so we're putting things forward. Yes, sir. I can see a question for me.
I don't know what exactly. So it appears that task force costs us money.
A little bit.
And so I'm trying to decide from a funding, and I'm not to suggest that we have abundance of money in the ODVA, but is that the intent that the money would be for this particular task force, or the intent would it be general funds and so it would just compete with other?
Out of ODVA, veterans monies for this? It's not my intention to use veterans funds for this one. That said,
trying to understand where, because they're all going to pile up down there, and I'm just trying to understand what they're coming up to.
This task force, in conversation with the speaker and others, this is the one ask for money that we're making in terms of a longer-term investment in seismic investments. So we've not been told not to ask for task force. Beyond that, could be a problem. Task force scale, so far it's a green light to understand that if we're going to start making investments in geographic areas, it makes sense to have the conversation first.
But I guess I meant OEM before. I didn't.
Oh, OEM. Yeah, right. Okay.
Sorry.
We are working on how we can leverage certain money set aside for seismic planning for
That's
this task force.
Okay. Sorry.
Yes, sir.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think I asked this on the original draft, and so I'm looking at the amendment to make sure the
Dash 4 amendment hasn't quite been drafted yet. But
okay. So the do you remember the question I asked about this?
Is there an emergency clause?
No. That wasn't it. Close. No. I've been asking this of every task force that I've been involved that in every committee is we have the Senate president picking two people, one
yes.
of which would be the chair of that committee.
Right.
Same with the speaker. One would be the chair of that committee, if I'm reading this right.
Right.
And I'm asking, could we, in the wonderful spirit of bipartisan and bicameral, have the minority leader and the minority leader over the other side appoint the other person?
I'm open to having that conversation. What we actually did it this way right now because in this particular context, it's a Republican chair of the committee in the Senate.
That's true.
And a Democratic chair here. So we are talking about that. There
okay.
are there are larger conversations way beyond my pay grade about who gets to choose what. But Senator Boquist and I are both committed to ensuring that every voice has a table at this particular issue. So I'm not above continuing to have that conversation. I think an amendment on that would be fine with me. But right now, we hadn't gotten to that point.
Sounds like Representative Post is angling for a job on this task force.
No, actually, he's not. But he is very interested. I'm serious. In our economic development trade, Representative Clem wanted to form a task force or something, and I asked the same thing out of him.
I absolutely understand your perspective, and what the best I can say for sure is, on another bill, not this one, and it may not be a bill this session, but Senator Boquist and I are working through a redesign of the Oregon Homeland Security Council, of which I think it would be entirely appropriate for the two parties to pick who they want there, because there's going to be an intelligence piece that's there, which means costs and some other things. So Senator Boquist and I have had those conversations. We are certainly trying to figure out a way to be fair. That said, I'm not the speaker, and when they saw the size of 31, they thought it was big enough as it was. So I don't have a great answer for you right now.
Okay.
But if you want to put that amendment in, we'll deal with it.
I'm not going to. I'm just thinking I don't want to increase the amount of people. I just want to.
And right now it's two legislators from either
right.
from both chambers, because we're trying to keep it small.
So, okay. Yeah, I don't want to increase the number.
And that was what we were up against with this. With Homeland Security Council, I think it would be entirely fair. There's traditionally been an R and a D on the Senate side and R and D on the House side, and I think that would be very fair.
Okay. All right.
Other questions? Okay, so
We're hoping to get the Dash 4 amendments coming back. We're hoping to be able to move this. I see two names, Barnes Ellis and Andrew Phelps. Please come forward. Welcome to the House
Thank
Committee
you.
On Veterans Emergency Preparedness.
My name is Barnes Ellis, and I'm a resident of Representative Parrish's district, House District 37. My daytime job is I'm senior legal counsel at Mercy Corps.
Great.
But I'm here today appearing on behalf of the City Club of Portland, which has just completed a 9-month study on the issues relating to resilience following a Cascade subduction zone earthquake. Now, I had the privilege of serving on that committee, and I'm currently active on the advocacy committee. And we, the report itself is lengthy. You can access it online. And we have distributed, we hope you got them, these abbreviated executive summary.
And we'll put this on OLIS also just so you know that people that tune in or want more information, they'll also have access.
Perfect, perfect. Okay. The City Club is, has over 2,000 members, and they overwhelmingly supported the recommendations of the report. There are a couple of key provisions in the bill that you're considering that tie into this. One of those is you, the bill you're looking at would create this task force that would study upgrades to critical facilities and infrastructure, and I want to address that in a second. And secondly, and I thought this was very striking, you want a plan for energy self-sufficiency in the event of a disaster. Let me address that, because this was an area that I was particularly focused on as we did the study. Our state's liquid energy is concentrated in a 6-mile strip on the northwest side of the Willamette River. 90% of all the liquid fuel in the state flows through that. 100% of the jet fuel flows through that. Now, that facility was located where it is over 100 years ago, and it seemed to make sense at the time because we had no clue about earthquakes, and here was an area that they could put dredging spoils, make it flat, and the oil companies were bringing the fuel in by vessels, so you had to be on the river, and that's how it got started. But what do we have today? We have 64 huge storage tanks, many of which were built over 100 years ago, most of which were done with no seismic design, and they are on not just riverside liquefiable soils, but dredge fill liquefiable soils. And the thing about a Cascadia subduction zone earthquake, it's not just powerful, which is a 9.0 at the coast, and we're told that's about a 6.5 to a 7 by the time you get to the metropolitan area. But it's the length of the shaking. And those earthquakes shake for 4 to 5 minutes. And I've seen a video simile of what happens to liquefiable soil when it's sustained to prolonged shaking. And it's awful. It just turns to mush. So what we're looking at, and it's not just a metropolitan issue, this is the whole state, because we're not just looking at an enormous conflagration. And let me give you a clue on that. We talked to the emergency planners for Multnomah County, and their task is to locate places where we could have refugee centers. An obvious one is the High Plain up there at the University of Portland. They can't use it because they are so convinced that what will happen if we don't take some steps is a conflagration that will make the atmosphere so toxic, and it's right across the river, that they can't use that. We are looking at an environmental spill that would dwarf anything you've ever heard of. Exxon Valdez involved 30 million gallons. There's 780 million gallons capacity in this area. So nobody's kidding anybody. We're looking at a disaster waiting to happen. Now, is there something we can do about it? Well, you can say, well, move it. Well, that's almost impossible. None of the companies that operates there has any interest in spending that kind of money. And frankly, in today's political climate, I don't think you'd ever reach agreement on a relocation prior to the event. So I think we're stuck with what we have. But there are some things you can do, and there are two of our recommendations that I'm speaking to you today, but I hope this task force gets composed and that we get a chance to work with them. One is it's totally too expensive to tear down the tanks, do the work, then rebuild the tanks. Two of the companies have done some of that, but there's just no indication we're going to get significant movement that way. But I was part of the group that interviewed Professor Studlin at Oregon State. He's a very well-known geologist. He says that there are techniques available, and this is deep grouting, it's lateral drilling, it's inserting pilings that would stiffen the whole area and not just under a particular tank. He said the cost to study that would be about $1 million, which to me is like chump change in the league that we're talking about. So the first thing we hope that this task force, if it gets going, does is to look at that. I hope DAGAMI gets funding. This is a study that ought to happen as soon as we can. The second thing, and this was a real surprise to me, I've told you I'm a lawyer, so I get into this and I say, well, surely somebody has regulatory responsibility to work in that area with the oil companies. And I can tell you, nobody does. Not the federal pipeline people, not PUC, not DEQ, not anybody you can think of. And so you're sitting there with the biggest disaster this state has ever faced, predictable. We all know it's there, and there is no one working with those companies to kind of push them along to do remedial steps.
Mr. Ellis.
Yes.
On that note, before, highly recommend you look up House Bill 2889, and before you leave, you meet with Mr. Harriman, who's sitting in the back.
I know Mr. Harriman.
There is a task force on secure pipelines and storage facilities currently working itself through a different committee that is focused on technologies that were developed during the Iraq War that can actually contain the materials so there is not an environmental leak.
I will do that as soon as I finish here. I'll find him in the back of the room.
He's kind of smiling and nodding right now, but continue, please, sir.
So I'll go fast on this because apparently you're on top of it. But there is a regulatory structure in California called MOTAMS, and it's the Marine Oil Terminal something or other. And that works with the fuel companies to prevent spillage. But it's a partnership arrangement. So you have regulatory, you have owner, and they work together and they push the owners to make the kind of improvements to avoid spills. We think it presents a good model and something that this task force that you're talking about should consider. A couple of other things in our report that I think make us very supportive of developing a task force. You know, we had the Oregon Resilience Plan, which I thought was a great project. It moved people along. We've got to keep focused on this. So the other two I wanted to mention, infrastructure, are the bridges in the metropolitan area. And it's, again, it's not a pretty picture. Most of those bridges are owned by Multnomah County. Of theirs, the only one that's expected to survive is the new Selwood Bridge. The Metro has the Tillicum Crossing Bridge. That's probably going to survive. Both of them have access that may get impaired, but we think it's reparable. And every other one of those bridges that we're all so familiar with are very likely to not only not be crossings, but they'll be river barriers because they're going to fail. Our report concludes the bridge that we ought to invest in, so we have at least one crossing that of a major bridge, is Burnside. And that's one that, again, as your task force goes forward, we would encourage them to help focus on that, because we've got to have at least one viable crossing. The last thing I'll comment on, this is an area I know all of you are interested in this topic, but unreinforced masonry structures. And I think it's embarrassing that Mr. Harriman's office in Portland is in a URM.
Sorry, Mike.
We have a number of other suggestions. My purpose here today is to encourage you do what you're doing, which is to focus on this issue. The data we have, and you've all read it, there's a 14 to 20% risk of a 9.0 Cascadia subduction zone earthquake in the next 50 years. That's not quite as good odds as Russian roulette. So thank you.
That closing I'm going to remember forever. That's thank you, sir, for that comment.
Happy to take questions.
Questions for Mr. Ellis? Well, I don't have a question, but I have a request, sir.
Okay.
Once you connect with Mike about this particular task force, I'd like to volunteer you. We call it in the military voluntold. Volunteer you for your involvement on that one particular.
I'd be delighted to do that. And I'm really obviously motivated.
And we'll keep your organization in informed on as we move these other things forward so that your input can be there. So appreciate all the work that you're doing.
Thank you.
Sir?
Thank you, Chair Evans. Members of the committee, I'm Andrew Phelps, Director of the Oregon Military Department's Office of Emergency Management. I'd like to begin by saying the sun was out for a few moments, so that's nice.
Oh, we missed it again.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you.
What did we do wrong?
Right in the mood a little bit.
We were kind of busy. We missed it.
And that's all the good news I've got. I am here today to provide testimony on House Bill 2983. Certainly mitigating the impacts of hazards and compressing recovery times are cornerstones of every effective emergency management program. And should this bill become law, OEM would fully support the effort to build upon recommendations from the State Resilience Plan and develop strategies leading to prioritized infrastructure upgrades, plans for increased energy independence following a disaster, and the identification of spaces and facilities to accommodate an influx of response resources, as well as populations displaced by a disaster. The Oregon Military Department has not submitted a fiscal impact statement for this impact and the impact of this task force, the impact it would have on our team. I would, however, ask that the committee be mindful of the cumulative impacts of creating multiple task forces staffed by the Office of Emergency Management, given the existing workload of our office and our strong desire to be successful in any effort we are asked to support. The Oregon Military Department takes a neutral position on this bill, and that concludes my prepared remarks.
You mean you can't staff 15 task forces all at the same time?
We can.
We'll limit it to
but
two.
But it's okay. A quality issue, sir.
Okay. Other questions for Mr. Phelps? And all kidding aside, I do appreciate the impact that it can be. I'm hoping that we keep the workload down so that one, as one finishes, the other one kind of picks up, so it's not all at one time or too much pressure. But as you know, in this building, sometimes you have to have a list of recommendations in order to move legislation. And with so much at stake, we have to have something that we can use as a tool to dislodge some people's comfort with the reality we have. But thank you. Any questions for Mr. Phelps? All right. Thank you very much, sir. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Any other people want to come forward on this that didn't sign up? Going once, going twice,
three times? Nope. All right, we're going to close the public hearing on 2983. My goal, again, is to have the amendment, dash four amendments, and the paperwork for that coming up at the next meeting. Maybe. Maybe at the next meeting. Maybe. We're gonna bag. I want to open up an informational discussion. I wanted, because of time and circumstance, I wanted to give Representative Lewis an example, a few minutes to talk about a bill you're going to be bringing forward. We had hoped to be able to introduce it today. Legislative Council is very busy, but I want to assure everybody that we will move this bill with all due speed if the committee so chooses. So go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, you probably recall the conversation that Water Resources had with us a few weeks ago about dams. And during their presentation, I asked a question about high hazard dams and how many of them have an emergency action plan. And was surprised to find out that they all don't have, nor are they required to, under current law. And so I did some research in the Oregon administrative rules and found out that Water Resources, if an entity, public or private, is currently in the process of constructing a high hazard dam, and those are defined as ones where there's a substantial risk of loss of life downstream. There is a requirement under administrative rule, if it's a new dam under construction, that they have an emergency action plan. But the administrative rule goes on to say that existing dams are encouraged to have one. And so this bill that I've drafted would require that any high hazard dam have an emergency action plan. And it goes a little bit further than that. It defines the high hazard dam, and it talks about what has to be included in the emergency action plan. And it has a requirement that the owner of the dam, whether it's public or private, work with Oregon Emergency Management on a timeline for how often it needs to be inspected, and also requires that the emergency action plan be delivered to Water Resources, Oregon Emergency Management, and also the county emergency management for whatever county the dam is located in. And then it requires periodic updates and review of the plan. So that's the bill. It's currently an LC draft form, and I'm waiting on one minor change to it, and then we'll be ready to go with it.
Representative Lewis's bill not only, I think, brings great attention to something that was a surprise to many of us, but the other piece is, through his discovery, we found out that there actually is no statutory definition of high hazard. It's in rule, which that seems kind of goofy, but we're going to try to fix that. And that bill hopefully will be coming forward soon.
So, yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was it, Rep. Lewis, was it from the League of Women Voters issues?
Was it what? I'm sorry.
But did it come from the League of Women Voters?
No.
I had somebody in my office talking about Hag Lake Dam and about...
No, actually, I've had no conversation.
Okay.
This Water Resources came and presented.
It's Water Resources,
yeah,
that
they
one.
Presented. Oh,
okay. Right, I, yeah. I may have missed
all right.
That one.
Last bit of business is I'm hoping on Thursday that everybody can get here on time. We're going to have a number of bills. We have two HCRs.
Four? Two HCRs and two
Two HCRs, so for the families, and then we have a couple of other bills, two HJMs that I believe will be very fast because they're simply memorials to Congress about funding levels that we've talked about in this body before.
This is the one I put in for
last.
This will be the seventh one.
Right. So on paper it looks like a lot. If everybody gets here on time, my goal is to get you out on time. The last piece is that the two audits, or the conversations about audits, are coming in. My view on audits, the way the state of Oregon does audits, this is not a gotcha. This is where we were and what steps have been taken and what we've learned and how we're moving forward. I'm really grateful that the agencies involved, if not excited about it, or at least being open about it, and the auditors involved were selected because of their recognition that
their job is to not be as much of a gotcha, as much of a staff assist in terms of improving so we can make sure that our dollars are stretched further. So it's going to be a good conversation. Looking forward to it. We have two of the two discussions on that, two HCRs for families, two HJMs, and then a couple other bills. It's going to be full agenda, but if we get here on time, we can get out on time. So hearing nothing else, we're now adjourned for the day. Have a wonderful day.
Thanks,
Wonderful day. You're not over here.